Support for NPR and the following message come from Vimeo Create. You don't have to be an expert to create high-quality videos for your business. Add clips, pick a template, and let the smart tools of Vimeo Create handle the rest. More at vimeo.com/create.
This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. For much of the month of June, the area around Seattle's Cal Anderson Park was a protest zone.
In the past several hours, police and protesters have been clashing in Seattle.
This is in the Capitol Hill neighborhood, right near Cal Anderson Park.
These streets, these six blocks in the heart of Seattle, have essentially been taken over by thousands of Seattle community members.
The blocked-off area was set up by protesters after days of clashes with police following the death of George Floyd.
Weeks before, Cal Anderson Park became the center of Seattle's Black Lives Matter movement. It was the place where former high school basketball star Kamijah King agreed to sit down for an interview. Kamijah hasn't been participating in recent protests. She says she's too angry, and she worries the protests could trigger her trauma. But recently, Kamijah has been dreaming of a different way of bringing about change, and it all started with basketball. Reporter Eilish O'Neill has her story.
Kamijah King's the oldest of six girls.
I remember moving just about every year. When I was in elementary school and in middle school, I remember having to live with my dad's mom because we were technically homeless.
Kamijah had a lot of responsibilities growing up. She says she was in third grade when she started cooking for herself.
There was never an expectation in the house that my mom would cook. She would say, go in the kitchen and find what you can find. Most times there wasn't anything to find, but if we did, there was just the expectation that we would have to make it for ourselves.
To distract herself from the problems at home, Kamijah played playground basketball.
I like going hard, just going full speed, passing people, beating people off the dribble. That's why I like the game so much. I can be aggressive. I can let out anger, and I can just, you know, let things go.
In second grade, one of Kamijah's friends told her he was on a basketball team.
And I was like, what, you're on a basketball team? I had no idea that you could be on a basketball team. And so I asked my mom if I could be on a basketball team.
So Kamijah's mom signed her up for a team at a community center. In middle school, she joined an AAU team. She was talented. And not just on the court. She was in all honors classes, and it was easy for her to get straight A's. Her English teacher recognized her potential and took her to visit two of Seattle's top private high schools, Lakeside and University Prep.
And I didn't actually like Lakeside very much. I wanted to apply to University Prep because the classes were smaller, but also they had a nice ice cream bar. And I was like, wow, this is nice. I can have ice cream whenever I want.
But then a friend pointed out, University Prep played sports in the 1A league against other small high schools with only a few hundred students. Even though Lakeside was also a small school, it played in the more competitive AAA league against schools more than twice its size.
I'd rather play 3A against better competition instead of playing 1A against smaller schools. And so that was the ultimate decision.
There was one more hurdle. At the time, Lakeside required an application essay from parents. At first, Kamijah's mom didn't want to write one.
She looked at the price tag and she thought it was crazy. And she was like, why do you want to go to this school?
Kamijah and her English teacher convinced her mom that if she got in, she'd get financial aid. So her mom agreed to write the essay. In 2012, Kamijah got into Lakeside on the strength of her academics alone. Lakeside doesn't consider athletic ability in admissions.
When I first saw the campus, I couldn't even believe that it was a high school. I was actually really confused because it looks like a college campus. When they told me that they had free periods, that you could use a free period to study with the tutor or do homework, and that no one would be keeping tabs on you, or that you could use your phone in between classes, I was like, what kind of place is this? And everyone has laptops. And so I was like, oh man, I'm gonna look like an idiot. I don't know how to work a laptop. Everyone was going from building to building for classes, and I was like, how do you know where you're going?
From the start, Kamaija had trouble making friends.
You come in as this brown girl who is completely different, has a different culture. No one's asking you about yourself.
Kamaija remembers one time in a freshman history class when she tried to contribute to the conversation. Her classmates treated her as if she was dumb, and the teacher didn't do anything about it.
And I was like, well, my teacher's not going to say anything, then I just won't talk anymore. And so I stopped talking in class after that because I didn't feel safe to speak.
One day, the topic of slavery came up in her history class, and one of her classmates...
He was defending why white people believed that black people were dumber. He was like, well, there was actually scientific studies that were coming out. And yes, that's true, but don't defend that point. That's completely ridiculous. I'm freaking human just like you. There is no difference.
Kamaija says the curriculum didn't include anything about contributions of people of color in society. And during Kamaija's junior year, all they did during Black History Month was show a video in assembly. Kamaija says that's when she lost all motivation to work hard in school.
I didn't feel like people kind of understood what I was going through because Lakeside kids don't have the same problems that I have. So who can I talk to? Who's going to understand why I'm coming to school late every day? People didn't want to be in projects with me. They thought I was a bad student, but I was just dealing with my own problems.
Kamaija's family was homeless part of the time, living in their car. When they did have a home, the seven of them shared a two-bedroom apartment, Kamaija's mom in one room and all six girls in the other. Kamaija says at one point, she visited the house of one of her classmates on the way to a school dance.
And I saw her home, which looked like a castle. And they had a boat out in front, and I was like, whoa, things are very different for us. Like, I'm just worried about simple things like having toiletries or getting a meal, and you have a castle.
Kamaija says at her home, there was no quiet place to do her homework.
It's really stressful when all you can think about is just like trying to survive. It's just worry, worry, worry for the most part. How am I supposed to do well in school when I have to worry about cleaning my mom's house all the time and making myself dinner or worrying about if I'm even gonna have dinner?
Lakeside did try to help. They included lunch in Kamaija's scholarship and started including extra meals when they figured out she needed breakfast and after-school snacks, too. Kamaija was also dealing with the trauma from being sexually abused, and Lakeside got her a counselor.
I would be a different person if I hadn't gone to Lakeside. I had so much support that my siblings didn't have.
And Kamaija also had basketball.
Playing basketball helps you keep your mind off of things because you have all this stress from school. You don't have to think as much as you would if you were in class, especially at Lakeside. You can just have fun, play basketball.
Kamaija's really fast and was used to just blowing by people and getting layups. But this one time, she had a defender on her that she just couldn't shake.
I was like dribble, dribble, between the legs, behind the back, step back. Step back is kind of a shifty move, so people are always caught off guard.
The person guarding Kamaija fell.
Oh, wow. I'm open. I'm going to shoot it. Shot the ball, swished it. I was like, oh, look at me. Okay. My boyfriend showed me a video of everyone screaming.
When people come up to me after the game, it's like, oh, you're so exciting to watch. You're so explosive. You make it look easy. Like, you do all these really cool moves. I'm like, oh, thanks. I'm glad that people can understand my joy. The way that I feel, I can make them feel also, the way I play.
As time went on, Kamaija started putting more and more into basketball.
My parents, they both didn't go to college, so it's not like they were going to help me with the process or make sure that I was turning things in on time. That's why I didn't really focus on academics that much at Lakeside. I was like, I'm just trying to get a basketball scholarship.
She did get a basketball scholarship to play at University of Alaska in Anchorage, a Division II school. But after a year, she returned to Seattle. Now she's focused on another dream. It's an idea that came to her during her senior year of high school. She was writing a paper about what it meant to her to be Black.
I just started thinking about Black empowerment and how unempowered I felt at Lakeside.
Kamai just started thinking about all the support she got at Lakeside and how important that was to her, but also ways the school could have done better.
And I was like, wow, like I'm into education. I want to start a school.
Lakeside is working to be more welcoming for students of color and students from poor families. The school got rid of the admissions essay for parents to make it easier on students like Kamaija. Jamie Asaka is the school's director of equity and inclusion, and she's an alumna herself.
I had a very challenging experience at Lakeside. I came from a public school. There were very few of us that came from a public school. I identified as a student of color. There were very few of us who identified as a student of color. My family also had, we experienced some hardships, and I did not feel like a lot of people in the community experienced similar hardships.
Jamie says Lakeside now provides additional help for students who need it, including home internet and passports for students who want to go on the school's international service trips. She started an alumni mentoring program for Black students. And she says Lakeside has also changed its hiring practices to try to attract a more diverse pool of job candidates. On top of that, she adds, the school is trying to train teachers to better moderate conversations, like the one where Kamaija felt attacked by her classmates when they treated her like she was dumb.
We came up with a two-day training for our colleagues so that they are equipped. When a student expresses an opinion or a belief, you know, perceived as controversial.
As for Kamaija, she's taking online college classes and working as an Amazon delivery driver to make ends meet. And while she hasn't joined the protests in Seattle, Kamaija says she's glad they're happening. She says different people have different roles to make sure the change the protesters are demanding becomes long-lasting. Kamaija feels her role is starting a school, like Lakeside in terms of its resources for students, but with a curriculum that focuses more on the contributions of people of color. She believes she's the person for the job.
That's all I think about now these days, is starting a charter school.
Kamaija King still plays some pickup basketball, but for the most part, it's not that big a part of her life anymore. It's just how she got to where she is now.
That's reporter Eilish O'Neill in Seattle. It's been a different kind of summer vacation. No spending long afternoons in crowded public swimming pools or watching the latest blockbuster in a packed movie theater. But even during a pandemic, some rites of childhood don't change. Here's commentator Alyssa Eli.
Since the Earth has shifted on its axis, and since we're not supposed to leave the state, we're not hiking in mountains anymore. But we do have the good fortune of a front porch with Adirondack chairs. We sat there recently watching a little girl perched on a red two-wheeler, low to the ground but clearly too high for her liking. Its handlebars were glittering with ribbons. Her father held onto the bicycle seat, jogging slowly down the middle of the empty road. Our street is level, but you could tell she had no faith. I remember that faithlessness. My first bike had the same kind of ribbons. On a different flat stretch of road, someone I knew and loved ran beside me, telling me to hold on and pedal, while I shrieked into the wind for him to hold on. What was wrong with him? There was not a single reason on the planet to have faith. In front of our house, the little girl, we never learned her name, wobbled to one side, then the other. Her father let the seat go briefly. She screamed. The next day they were back in the middle of the road again. Her father let the seat go. She wobbled and screamed. It went on for a week or so while we watched from the porch, waiting for magic to take hold. We had the faith that she didn't. It was like being in an Olympic stadium, cheering on your nation, even if the athlete can't hear. I was inside for a few days, busy with obligations and distractions that continue even in the middle of global disaster. When I returned to the Adirondack chair, the street was empty at first. Then she came into view, riding a red bike, pedaling very carefully, unassisted. Her father walked behind her. She looked over at the porch as she passed, a quick glance not to lose balance, and smiled briefly. He recognized us and gave a thumbs up. We gave two back, a standing thumb ovation. Our nation had taken the gold. It's true that we were more than 6 feet apart, but that's how strangers come together now.
Alyssa Eli is a psychiatrist. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Need to escape the news for a moment?
Check out Endless Thread, a podcast from WBUR and Reddit.
From mysteries to histories to stories that will remind you of our shared humanity.
Subscribe to Endless Thread on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given. During his 16-year pro boxing career, Maurice Termite Watkins learned how to face down an opponent. He used those skills while working as an independent contractor in Iraq. But a few months ago, the 63-year-old former professional athlete was faced with a new challenge, COVID-19.
This hit me out of nowhere. It blindsided me. It was totally out of my control.
Reporter Tal Pinchevsky has the story.
Maurice Watkins barely ever responds to his birth name. He's always been Termite. It makes sense, considering his family owned a pest control business in Houston. And although the nickname was inspired by his small frame and wiry disposition as a child, it's even more apropos in his adulthood. After all, termites aren't just hard workers, they're incredibly resilient. Those qualities serve Termite well in the ring.
I fought for the world championship 1980.
The history of boxing is on the line. So is Larry Holmes' title. Muhammad Ali can definitely...
It was when Ali fought Holmes. It was a double main event. I had the other main event. So a huge time. Got through with the fight. I came back home. Very shortly after that, I was introduced to cocaine. And for probably the next 5 years or so, I had a major cocaine problem.
Termite was in the throes of full-blown addiction when one morning, after running into two acquaintances during a routine drug deal,
I got a phone call, and they said, you're lucky. I said, what are you talking about? I was just woken up, and it was a girl, and she says, they let you leave because of who you are and because of your name. They felt like it would get a lot of publicity, and they let you live. And I said, well, what are you talking about? And they said, Bill and this other guy are both dead. They were shot gangland style. One was shot walking up a stairs, and then the other one was sleeping, and they walked up and placed it right at his forehead, or, from what I understand.
That brush with death set Termite straight. He quit drugs, committed his life to his faith, and returned to boxing, collecting 11 more wins and a draw before calling it a career. He retired after 69 pro bouts with 61 victories, 42 by knockout. He was 33 years old. Termite went to work for his family's pest control business for a while. Then, in early 2003, fate dealt him another unexpected hand in the form of a call from a friend representing the United States military.
And he said, well, they're needing the pest control support. And I told my former wife that, you know, it felt like I was being called to go to Iraq. And she laughed at me and she basically said, I don't hear that call. So a period of time went by, and I believe it was probably a week or two. And one day her and my kids came to me and they said, we've never seen you so passionate about doing something, and we give you our blessings to go to Iraq.
4 weeks later, Termite Watkins was in Iraq as an independent contractor. Working in temperatures that soared above 125 degrees, Termite rid the U.S. bases of scorpions, cobras, rodents, and spiders up to a foot long. But his mission was suddenly altered when he met a colonel named Stephen Bruce.
And I said, I hear an accent. Where are you from? He says, I'm British, can't you tell? He said, what do you ask? I said, well, you know, they've had some great boxers in Britain. He says, and what do you know about boxing? And I said, I know everything about boxing. And I actually mocked him. And he says, have you ever boxed? I said, yes, I've boxed. And he says, were you any good? I said, I was the best. And he says, meet me on the British side tomorrow morning.
The British colonel was looking for a trainer. Before long, Termite was leading a 40-soldier boxing clinic. It didn't take long for Termite's boxing reputation to spread throughout the region. That's when an American ambassador came calling with an unexpected question.
What are the odds of getting Iraq to the Olympics?
In other words, could Termite train an Iraqi citizen to reach the Olympics in boxing?
I kind of chuckled. I said, you have a slim to none chance of getting them to the Olympics. I said, maybe a one in a million. He says, great. All we need is one. We don't need the million. I expect you to get this done.
With a military security detail by his side, Termite combed the war-torn country in search of boxers that could help get Iraq to the 2004 Olympics in Athens, Greece. Less than a year before the games were scheduled to kick off, Termite's team assembled for the first time at the National Boxing Facility in Hilla, Iraq.
And all of a sudden, one little young guy starts coming up, and he was actually a little bit late. And he says, my name is Najah. I will be the one to represent Iraq in the Olympics. And I just smiled. I said, well, come on in.
Najah Ali was the 23-year-old reigning Iraqi champion. He had finished second in a regional tournament staged in Egypt, but the odds would be stacked against Termite and his team of Iraqi upstarts. For one thing, their facilities and equipment didn't meet even the most marginal standards. Never mind that their outdoor training sessions were accompanied by a chorus of gunfire and bomb blasts. One day, Termite was leading a team workout.
And all of a sudden, boom! And I started grabbing everybody, trying to tell them, you know, get under the benches. And they said, what are you doing? What are you doing? I said, get down. They're bombing us. They're bombing us. And they all started laughing. They said, no, Mr. Termite. Said, that is a transformer. It's not, you know, we're not being bombed. They were so used to bombs, they knew what the difference was between a transformer blowing up and a bomb.
Mere weeks before the game's opening ceremonies, Termite was informed that the Iraqi team had been awarded a special wildcard exemption, allowing a single Iraqi boxer to compete in Athens regardless of how they performed in Olympic qualifiers. After a team box-off and a vote among the fighters and team officials, Najah was selected to represent Iraq in Athens, just as he predicted he would when he first met Termite. Termite had successfully completed his mission to bring an Iraqi boxer to the Olympics, and Termite, an American, was planning to walk under the Iraqi flag alongside his boxer in the opening ceremonies. But the day before, he received a dire warning.
The Iraqis are afraid, and they had gotten some type of intelligence or something that if I was to actually walk out on the field with them, that people would die. And people, you know, towns would get attacked. Anyway, so I had to make a decision. Do I go out on the field and take a chance on somebody getting killed, or do I just pull back? So I prayed about it, and an incredible peace come over me that I had done my job, and this was it for me.
Termite sat in Greece's Olympic Stadium with 75,000 spectators as Najah walked out onto the field under the Iraqi flag.
Iraq! Iraq! Iraq!
And I cried. I have to be honest, I cried a whole lot of the time they were walking around the stadium, because I'm a real proud American, but to some degree, I felt part of the team because we had worked for 10 months to get them to the Olympics.
After the Olympics, Termite returned to Houston and relative normalcy, working a day job and continuing to train local boxers. Life remained mostly calm. Then came the COVID-19 pandemic and a business trip to Dallas in early March.
He'd gotten back from his trip on Tuesday, so his aching started Wednesday. So by Friday, he started having fever, low-grade fever.
That's Termite's wife, Cindy. They've been married since 2011.
And we did know about what was going on with the coronavirus, but I just kept thinking, making excuses, I guess, like, well, it's probably just the flu, because we did know some people that had the flu.
Cindy took her husband to the local emergency room, where they gave him antibiotics and sent him home. A few days later, they raced back to the emergency room, with Termite complaining of shortness of breath.
I remember going to the hospital and that second time, and I had to go in by myself. I had to hug my wife by. I knew there was a chance I'd have to get on the ventilator because I was feeling that bad. And so we did our hugs goodbye, and really I didn't think, I wasn't sure I'd ever see her again.
The next morning, I got a call from his caseworker telling me that he was in intermediate care. I didn't even know that he had been taken to that level. And the caseworker told me, if you know people that pray, you need to start praying. And I realized how serious it was at that point.
Termite had COVID-19. Less than 24 hours after being admitted, he called his wife to let her know that his condition had worsened and he was likely going to be intubated and put on a ventilator.
You know, what do you say when you're going to, when you think you're talking to the love of your life for the very last time? I just said, well, I love you with all my heart. And he said, I love you too. And I just tried to be strong while I was on the phone and just said, I love you, you know, and we're going to talk later. And you just be strong and fight, you know, because I knew he was a fighter.
And then I remember struggling to breathe. And then I remember when they laid me down and put the IV in my arm, and then all of a sudden I went out, and that's all I remember.
After a lengthy pro boxing career, after surviving an unusual mission in Iraq, after everything he'd been through, Termite Watkins was in for the fight of his life. Cindy documented his progress on Facebook. There were good days and bad days. Here she is reading part of her post from April 14th, 4 weeks after Termite was admitted.
This morning, I did not hear the news I wanted to hear, but I have to trust that God is continuing to bring healing through Termite's incredible medical team. Termite was reintubated and placed back on the vent early this morning. As hard as it is for me to deal with, I am glad that he is not struggling so hard. His nurse FaceTimed me for just a few minutes so I could see him. He does look more comfortable and his color looks good, so my heart was satisfied.
On April 21st, after 35 days in the hospital and 18 days on a ventilator, Termite was finally discharged from the hospital.
Couldn't walk, so I was in a wheelchair. And I remember, you know, being rolled down the hall and coming out the door. And all of a sudden there was, you know, number one was my wife, and then all the friends and family.
The moment was streamed live on Facebook.
Termite strong! Woo!
And it was just a great day.
Yeah.
He was 35 pounds lighter and so weak he could barely handle his phone or get in and out of bed. Within a few weeks, the 63-year-old Termite was back to his usual routine and even driving again. I asked him, in a lifetime of battles, was this the toughest yet?
Yeah, you know, over in Iraq, all I had to worry about was people shooting at me and bombs going off, stuff like this. I could control somebody shooting at me or a bomb going off because I could get behind cover. Getting off the drugs was very tough because your system craves it, but I had a lot of people helping me there. But this is probably the... Yeah, I would say this was the toughest.
You almost died.
Yeah, I almost died.
Whether it was staring down an opponent in the ring, or training Olympic hopefuls in Iraq, or fighting for every last breath in a hospital bed, whenever Termite Watkins found himself in unusual circumstances and forced to fend for himself, he always came out swinging.
That's reporter Tal Pinchevsky. Termite Watkins has continued to see plenty of highs and lows since he returned to health. On June 5th, his mother, Wanda Watkins, passed away. Around the same time, he signed an agreement with a production company fronted by a Hollywood icon who intends to make a film about Termite's life. Valentino Dixon spent 27 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. He says that should worry everyone.
Yeah, because it could happen to you or a loved one. It could happen to a family member. You know, this is why it's so serious.
Coming up, how drawings of golf courses led to Dixon's exoneration. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Doesn't love a good story? On Circle Round, the storytelling podcast from WBUR, we adapt folktales from around the world as radio plays, featuring beloved stars of the stage and screen, like Seinfeld's Jason Alexander, Hamilton star Philippa Sue, and Emmy, Grammy, and Tony Award winner Billy Porter. Circle Round has been named a top kids podcast by The New York Times, Good Housekeeping, and Time Magazine, and we think you'll love it too. Find Circle Round wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, former MLB All-Star Ryan Dempster talks about performing stand-up comedy at an open mic the night before his first start at Fenway Park. But now it's time for Charlie Pierce and the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
In a report published by the Washington Post, more than a dozen former female employees of Washington's NFL team have accused team executives, including former COO Mitch Gershman, of repeated instances of sexual harassment. This is Emily Applegate, the only woman named in the Post's report.
It really took most people no time to comment on my appearance, and it really took no time for Mitch to let me know that I was incompetent of doing small tasks that he was demanding of me.
The NFL says it will wait for the result of an independent investigation before deciding whether or not to take action. What do you make of all this?
It was mind-blowing to me. I'm intrigued by the possible connections between their sudden come-to-Jesus moment on the nickname and this story appearing. I'm beginning to wonder if they decided to, you know, throw the nickname out there as Squid Ink to obscure the attention to this, you know, obviously systemic problem with his female employees. It's also past time for the NFL to take some action on Dan Snyder.
Even before the report dropped, the team hired an outside attorney to, quote, review the organization's protocols. It's got to be bad when you hire an attorney to look into allegations that haven't even been released yet, don't you think?
Well, yeah, not only that, but the phrase review the team's protocols means essentially tear this place apart and find out where the rats are living. Defining the protocol is a legal term for a fairly thorough house cleaning.
Well, as you mentioned, the team announced on Monday that they will change their nickname. But since they haven't chosen a new name yet, they are still, for now, the name I do not say on radio or elsewhere. And they use that name and their logo multiple times in the press release. So basically, they've learned nothing, right?
Yeah, he's going to show us, isn't he, Dan Snyder? He's going to show the world that he's not intimidated. He can't even stay consistent with his own distractions.
Over the past 6 years, a Virginia man has filed trademark claims to at least 44 potential new names for that team. 61-year-old Martin McCauley holds the rights to the Washington Red Wolves, Red Tails, Monuments, Veterans, Red-Tailed Hawks, Americans, Braves, Renegades, Freedom Fighters, and the Radskins.
First of all, I don't think he's got a prayer with Radskins. I don't even know what that's supposed to be. But I don't hear kickbacks on that list. So maybe it's time for me to get on the phone with the trademark people.
For their part, baseball's Atlanta Braves have said that they are not considering a name change. But in an email to fans, the team said that the Tomahawk Chop will be reviewed by an advisory group. Do you expect anything to come of this?
How are they going to stop it?
Yeah.
They will certainly put a committee on it, which means nothing will be solved for at least 5 years.
Well, and to your point, I mean, they can't stop it, but they could stop promoting it.
Yeah, they could stop using the organ and the in-stadium, you know, entertainment complex to encourage it. Yes, they could do that.
When the NBA restarts later this month, players will be allowed to replace the name on their jersey with one of a number of league-approved social justice messages. But the Miami Heat's Jimmy Butler has asked instead that the back of his jersey remain blank to make the point that if he wasn't an NBA player, he'd be, quote, no different than anybody else of color. It's an interesting message, don't you think?
Hey, Marquette guy, represent. First of all, you know, he's going to stand out if he's got nothing on there, so it'll help his brand. And second of all, his explanation is a good one. I kind of hope it catches on.
For headline of the week, I'd like to nominate this from USA Today. Quote, life inside the bubble with NBA players, golfing, fishing, and shotgunning beers. Literally none of those things are happening inside my closet.
And not only that, all of those three things happen simultaneously anyway. I mean, except golfing and fishing, maybe. But shotgunning beers is necessary to both activities.
And finally, Charlie, last week we spoke of liquor store employee Katie Camlin, who broke the news of Patrick Mahomes' blockbuster contract extension after a Chiefs employee came in to buy half a dozen bottles of Dom Perignon. Well, it's happened again. This time it was caught on tape.
Oh my God. Chiefs came in again. Six more bottles. My guess is Chris Jones.
Citizen journalism. We might as well just quit now, eh?
Hey, there you go. Either that or the Chiefs have to find another liquor store.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
Valentino Dixon grew up playing basketball and football, but he didn't play golf. He says the mere mention of it in his neighborhood would get you shot. But for about 20 years, Valentino did visit golf courses, if only in his imagination. Only a Game's Gary Wallach explains.
Valentino Dixon is an artist.
I learned to draw when I was about 3 years old.
His early drawings were mostly of cartoon characters and Disney figures. But they weren't an escape from the tough East Buffalo neighborhood where he lived.
Well, not at the time. It became an escape for me later on in life.
Dixon attended a school for the arts when he was a teen, but he started hanging out with drug dealers. When he was a bit older, he dealt cocaine to support his baby daughter. He often carried a gun. He was out on bail for possession charges on the night of August 10th, 1991.
I was hanging out at a fast food restaurant.
It was a popular night hangout spot, and there was a melee.
That's journalist Max Adler. He says there were about 70 teenagers at the restaurant that night.
There was a fist fight that turned into a gunfight.
Shots rang out, and I took off, jumped in my car, pulled away.
He fled, didn't want to have anything to do with this. There were four people shot, one of whom, Toriano Jackson, was 17 years old. He died.
Shortly thereafter, I was pulled over, taken in for questioning.
And what did the cops ask you then?
They asked me, was I at the scene of the crime, which I told them yes. Next thing you know, I'm being charged with murder.
Dixon couldn't believe what he was hearing, but he felt eyewitness accounts would clear him.
There were dozens of witnesses, all of whom gave conflicting accounts of what happened.
According to Adler, seven eyewitnesses insisted that Dixon had not committed the crime. And just 2 days after the shooting, a man named Lamar Scott confessed to the murder. And yet, the prosecution of Valentino Dixon proceeded.
Nobody wanted to admit that a mistake was made. It came down to embarrassment. It came down to egos. The culture was that, you know, we're not going to say that we made a mistake here. Anybody that know me know that I was never capable of what they accused me of. And that's what hurt me to the core. You know, why would you accuse me of this? And then when you realize that I didn't do it, why would you ignore that you made a mistake? I mean, that's like the worst thing in the world that you can blame a person for is murder. Like, come on, it don't get no worse than that.
The case went to trial in 1992. Dixon hoped the discovery process would clear his name. But
next thing you know, the prosecutor's charging two of the witnesses with perjury before trial. for stating that I did not commit the crime. He charged him with perjury.
Again, Max Adler.
And then this made other witnesses afraid of coming forward. Instead of just kind of letting a jury have all the facts and letting them sort it out, the prosecutor very vindictively selected who could testify, and that was only the people who agreed with his version of the story.
A good attorney would have been able to protect his client, but Dixon's public defender, who had only visited him once in the 10 months leading up to the trial, was anything but that.
Trial begun. The lawyer didn't even give an opening argument. He waived his opening argument. And then he didn't call any witnesses, not one witness to the stand. He didn't even introduce one exhibit during trial. The jury found me guilty, gave me 38 years.
38 and a half years to life, to be precise. In 1992, at the age of 21, Valentino Dixon went to Attica, the infamous maximum security prison in western New York State.
For the first 7 years, I was such in a state of depression. You know, I didn't have no drive or no determination when it came to anything positive.
Valentino learned what he could about the law at the prison library. He kept a meticulous list of the mistakes that had been made in his trial. He filed an appeal.
This same judge, when we filed a post-conviction motion, said that I received a fair trial.
Adler says Valentino's family was still fighting for him.
His father did all he could to take the investigation into his own hands, and, you know, attorneys would sort of take his money and then not really do anything. It became his nightmare.
Dixon was despondent. But then he received a package from an uncle.
He sent me some color pencils and some paper. I kind of tossed him into the corner of the cell, you know, and he kept saying, hey, when are you going to use the pencils? And finally, I just came around and I says, all right, let me see what I can do. And, you know, when I started drawing, I was drawing everything from African art, abstract art, landscapes, animals, you name it. Once I picked up the pencils, I wouldn't stop.
Dixon drew every day. In 2010, his drawings got the attention of the warden.
One day he says, Dixon, you think you can draw my favorite golf course? I said, yeah, I'll draw for you. It's no more than a landscape and a flag, so why not?
The warden brought in a photo.
It was Augusta, I believe it was a 12-hole. I drew it for him. He loved it.
A cellmate told him he should draw some more golf courses.
I said, what am I going to draw golf courses for? What are you talking about? So he says, I think you can do good drawing golf courses. For whatever reason, he planted the seed. And I started drawing golf courses. It was the strangest thing in the world.
Strange because Valentino Dixon had never even set foot on a golf course. So he collected golf magazines and drew the pictures he saw in them. But he didn't just look at the photos.
I started reading the columns, and I came across Max's column, Golf Saved My Life.
That was the name of a monthly Golf Digest column Max Adler co-authored.
In which we chronicled the ways people used the game to get through a hard thing that they were going through in their life.
I had friends that committed suicide in prison. You know, you can be strong today and tomorrow you can be like, you know what, I got 20 years and I'm ending this. I can't do no more time. And I felt like at that point, I was on borrowed time and golf was saving my life.
Then one day in December 2011, Max Adler went to his office at Golf Digest.
And in my inbox was a little letter postmarked from Attica Correctional Facility, and inside was an amazing letter from Valentino.
In the letter, Dixon explained what had happened to him. He said he was innocent. And there was something else in the envelope, a tiny drawing.
It was a golf green surrounded by trees in autumn foliage, and it was just painstakingly rendered in layers upon layers of colored pencil to achieve a very vivid, rich color that's almost like painting. A tranquil image of grass and skies and tree, water. It was just as far away from his cell as you could possibly get.
Adler visited Dixon in early 2012. At first, he thought the story was about Dixon's art, not about his innocence.
I entered Attica that day with some serious doubts and questions about the story that he had told me. And sitting in the same room with him, he really spilled his heart out to me. Told me everything he could about his life and his case over the course of a few hours. And I left there convinced that a real injustice had been done and that I was going to try to do everything I could to tell the story.
Adler pored over thousands of legal documents. In July of 2012, the story appeared in Golf Digest.
It was a first-person piece written by Valentino Dixon, ghostwritten by me, which really just explained the peace and tranquility that he found in the look of this sport. And then attached to that was a much longer piece that investigated his case and showed that it was a pretty clear instance of local officials seizing the moment to railroad a young guy with a criminal background into prison for a crime he didn't commit.
Major news outlets became interested, and that wasn't all.
Golf Digest is really what led us to discover it.
That's Georgetown government and law professor Mark Howard. He's the director of Georgetown's Prisons and Justice Initiative. In January of 2018, Howard presented Dixon's case at Georgetown in a class called Making an Exoneree. Three undergrad students went to work.
And they actually visited him in prison, and they made a trip to Buffalo also, where they went to the crime scene, where they interviewed the original prosecutor, interviewed a number of witnesses and met his whole family, interviewed the current DA. So they really did an incredibly thorough job and became more and more convinced that Valentino was 100% innocent.
The current DA, Erie County Prosecutor John Flynn, promised he would thoroughly review the case. On September 19th, 2018, Valentino Dixon got his first real day in court. That day, he walked into court wearing shackles. He walked out a free man. On the day of his release, there was a party. Mark Howard, Max Adler, and many of Dixon's family members and friends joined him at the restaurant he'd seen in ads for decades on prison televisions.
We went to Red Lobster. I had never ate lobster before. So while I was in prison, that was like a dream, like a fantasy to me, for me to eat lobster.
Dixon says he's not bitter about the 27 years he spent in prison. But he says that if his drawing had not captured the attention of Max Adler, he'd still be sitting in jail.
I'm glad it worked, because I'll be honest with you, at one point I felt like, you know, the only way I could get out is through my artwork. So I said, well, maybe I can draw myself out of jail. And who could have predicted that?
He also says those who wrongfully convicted him should be embarrassed.
Well, yes, extremely embarrassed, because the law states that the prosecutor has a duty and an obligation to seek the truth, not just a conviction.
Mark Howard estimates that among this country's 2.3 million people in prison, 3 to 5% have been wrongfully convicted. That's about 100,000 people. Dixon says every American, not just African-American kids from tough Buffalo neighborhoods, should find that disturbing.
Yeah, because it could happen to you or a loved one. It could happen to a family member. You know, this is why it's so serious.
Since his release, Dixon's advocated for criminal justice reform. But he's also caught up on some fun. The first thing he did, he said, was to make breakfast for his mother and grandmother. In late 2018, he traveled to Mexico with Max Adler to play golf for the very first time. Before that trip, he told me,
I don't care how I do. It's going to be a wonderful moment, and I'm enjoying myself. What is a good score? 68. If I did 10 times worse than that, I'm still going to be happy just to be there. My score is 680, and I'll still be happy.
That story came from Only a Game's Gary Wallach. It first ran in November of 2018. Valentino Dixon has a website where you can see and purchase some of the 1,500 drawings he made while in prison. We'll have the link at onlyagame.org.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Aspiration. With an Aspiration debit card, you can choose to plant a tree with every purchase while accessing up to 20 times the interest of a traditional bank. Learn details when you sign up for a better world at aspiration.com/green.